to order at this time at 1:35. We have present Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Davis. The first order of business today is to go through some of the confirmations, and we do have them all online, or is anybody present? All online? Mm-hmm. And we'll start with Dr. John Collins. Dr. Collins, are you there?
I am here.
You want to state your name and actually have any statement you want to make before we ask any questions, if there are questions to be asked?
My name is John Stewart Collins. I'm a physician in Valdez, Alaska, and it's a great honor to serve on the board.
And we have three people present. Senator Elton, did you have a question of... a comment or a statement you want to make?
I don't, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Thomas?
Yes,
what's
Dr.
that?
Senator Thomas has a question.
Sure.
Dr. Collins, just any particular issues or concerns that you had that caused you to put your name forward? Or any particular goals you had in mind?
Not really. I think I was asked to submit my name as part of a rural, for a little bit of a rural voice on the medical board. I have a lot of experience in that. I've been working in Valdez now for going on 14 years. But no, I don't have any other specific goals or anything of that sort.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Could you just give us a little bit about your background and all?
Sure. I'm a family physician. I've been working, like I said, in Valdez for about 14 years. I do a full spectrum family medicine, including I deliver babies and do a fair amount of procedures and cover the emergency room. I've served as president of the Alaskan Academy of Family Physicians twice now. And then I also do a lot of national work with the American Academy of Family Physicians. So I have a fair amount of knowledge about rural issues. I've also been involved in the Alaskan Rural Health Council, which is a group of physicians discussing rural health issues.
All right.
Any other information?
Is there another? There is no other information, and we don't have but three people present today, and apparently you don't want to, none of those people had any concerns. We're just glad to have you want to serve in that capacity,
yes.
And glad that you could come and speak to us today.
Well, I'm very, like I said, it'll be a great honor, and I'll do the very best I can.
Thank you. Dr. Larry Stinson.
Yes. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
This is the Senate Health Committee, and this is Senator Davis. And present today is Senator Elton and Senator Thomas. Would you want to tell us why you want to serve on this board or give us a little of your background?
I basically grew up in Alaska. I have a great interest in providing the best care possible for the state. I've got relatives all over the state. This
is a great honor.
I would echo many of the same sentiments that Dr. Collins just gave.
Okay, are there any questions from other board members? Senator Thomas?
The same question I asked if you were listening. Any particular issues or concerns or goals that you have being on the board?
Okay, all right, thank you. Senator Elton?
Thank you, and Dr. Simpson, thanks for your willingness to serve. Just a quick question. I know that you're very active on one of the issues in front of the legislature, but I'm assuming that that is completely separate from anything that you would want to accomplish on the board?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I don't think that any particular issue politically has anything to do with the board, as far as I know. I don't think it's a political office, and I think unless I misunderstand, it's more for evaluating and policing the quality of medical care in the state.
That's exactly the kind of answer I wanted. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. There are no other questions. We thank you for coming before us, and good luck on the board. Is there a Geraldine Benchute?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Would you want to tell us why you wanted to serve on the board, or
what
you hope to achieve?
I have been a believer in public education all my life. I feel that personally and with my family and with my children, that without public education, we would not have been successes in our adult lives. And I also have been involved in the education, working as an educator since 1962. So public education is very dear to my heart. I, you know, have been a student, I've been a parent, and I've been an educator, so I feel that I've kind of seen it from several different viewpoints.
Are there any questions from the board members, committee members? Senator Thomas?
I'll ask the same one I ask of everybody, and thank you for making yourself available to serve. Are there any particular issues or concerns or goals that you have as you thought about putting your name forth?
I guess not really. I don't have any, irons to burn or anything. I, of course, have been involved in special education for most of my career, not as a parent, but strictly as an educator. And I know that special education is an issue right now with the funding, and also it seems that the percentage of special education students has increased a lot, and I'm very concerned that our education is for all students, but that it is appropriate for their abilities.
Thank you. Appreciate your answer.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I guess I should have said it to the other people that also spoke to us that these names will be forwarded now on for confirmation hearings. There will be no other need for you to have any contact with us. The name will be forwarded to the clerk, and I don't know when the meeting is going to be, but you will be informed of the date. Is there Philip, and I'm not able to pronounce your last name? Is it Snyder? Is there Larry Noreen there?
Philip Schneider should be on.
Hello?
Yes, who's speaking?
Yes, this is Philip Schneider.
Okay. Did you want to speak to the confirmation the board that you're going to be serving on as to why you are serving?
I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to call in.
Any question from the members?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and just kind of a broad question, so you can narrow it down as you wish. I mean, the opportunity to serve has been extended, and I'd be interested in why you said yes, you were interested in serving.
Well, I spent the last 10 years in public education. I started an international school a couple of years back, but I just had a chance to go, and I was president of the Utah Middle Level Association. left public education. I was working for the Anchorage School District, and I'm not interested in leaving. I left in the sense that it won't be my steady source of income any longer, but I'm interested in keeping my foot in the door. And actually, after getting my master's in policy, it's always interesting to me. So I do look forward to serving. I've kept up with volunteer work ever since I was a child.
And Madam Chair, just kind of a follow-up question. I appreciate that. So have you retired from the district, or have you moved to another job? And if so, what are you doing now?
I've retired from the district, but I've moved on.
In the private sector?
Yeah, I have my own business.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Once again, we'd like to thank you for taking this time to meet with us, and hope you'll be very happy with the board that you're going to be serving on.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So is there Larry Noreen?
Yes, this is Larry Noreen, Senator.
Hello there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Thank you.
Well, do you want to just give us a little bit about yourself and why you applied for this position?
Apply, and looking at the position, I was interested. I'm semi-retired, and I have an expertise in real estate and investments and valuation, and merely can't stay too idle, so I'm offering my services, and apparently it might match up well with the Mental Health Land Trust Board. So it's just a matter of public service. My family has given public service in our history in Alaska, going back to the territorial legislature, and I guess it's just my turn. So I'm just offering what assistance I can in my areas of expertise.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Thomas?
Yes, Mr. Noreen, what do you think you would bring to the Mental Health Trust Board? What specific expertise that you might lend?
Well, the decisions they likely make in managing their assets, I think I would be useful there. I'm successful in that in my personal life, and well-educated in those fields in real estate. I totally realize the increasing cost of providing care and the increasing number of beneficiaries. So it's almost exponential. So the mental health trust assets are going to have to produce adequate income in the future, you know, to help provide this benefit to the beneficiary. So a good stewardship there, I think, is necessary to see that income meet what potential it needs to meet to do that job.
Very good. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We have one other person that's supposed to come before us, Timothy. And I definitely can't pronounce your last name.
Senator, this is Tim Shirk.
Yes, Timothy?
Yes.
Would you want to just give an opening statement to us?
Certainly, thank you. I'm, as with the other appointees, deeply honored and humbled to be appointed. And I have a background in healthcare sustainability. Having worked in this for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium for many years as the General Counsel. And I look forward to, as with Mr. Noreen, looking carefully at the ways that, that the trust maximizes benefits for mental health trustees, and working closely with Jeff Jesse and the leadership of the trust to do our best to maximize
the
return for the benefit of the mental health trust.
Any follow-up?
Same question.
Thank you very much. Senator Elton, you have a question or a statement?
Just a quick a quick question on your background. I think it speaks well to your ability to bring some of your past experience into onto the board. Was your experience in tribal health, was it on the behavioral side, or the or was it as an administrator? I mean, what did you do for the?
The general counsel for the consortium. I'm not a behavioral health person per se, but basically. When we took over the Native Medical Center in the late 90s from Indian Health Service, there was a real question about whether we could figure out ways to bring money through the door sufficient to meet the needs of the Native, the health needs of the Native population, which was rapidly expanding and getting older as well. And so that's what I did as general counsel, is work with the do whatever we could to grow revenues and build a program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think there's no other questions. I do want to say to all those that came before us today that we're glad that you are able to serve on these boards, and I think the board will be improved with you being there. And so I look forward to seeing you later on as you serve in that capacity. If there is nothing else to come before us for confirmation, this will end the confirmation hearings. And we'll go on to the presentation that we now have. Best beginning, and I'd like for them to come forward. And we're going to hear from them on Alaska Early Childhood Investments. Early Learning and Best Beginnings. Will you state your name for the records?
Yes, Abby Hensley.
You may speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting Best Beginnings to talk with you today about a segment of our population whose success really is critical to our state's future and to our being competitive in an increasingly global economy. I'm talking about our youngest citizens, children from birth to age 6. I'm Abby Hensley, and I'm the executive director of Best Beginnings, the statewide initiative formerly known as Ready to Read, Ready to Learn. And that's when we came and spoke with you last year, was Ready to Read, Ready to Learn. But Best Beginnings is a public-private partnership bringing together people and resources to ensure all Alaska children begin school ready to succeed. I asked several colleagues to join me today, and I'll introduce them as they address you. You all should have a packet of information about topics that we'll talk about today, as well as several reports. A large and growing body of research provides increasing evidence of three related tenets. First, brain growth and development occurs at an astonishing pace in very young children. Second, nurturing and brain stimulation during those years has a profound impact on how children fare in school. And third, a child's readiness for school is a powerful determinant of how he or she will fare in life. Economists cite this linkage between a child's beginnings and success later in life as evidence that investments in early childhood development yield extraordinary returns. Children who have access to quality learning opportunities at home or in away-from-home programs are more likely to graduate from high school, get better-paying jobs, avoid spending time in jail, and lead more productive lives. They're more likely to develop critical thinking skills, pay higher taxes, and raise healthy families. They're less likely to go on welfare or be incarcerated. Economists began a rallying cry that has been picked up by business leaders across the country. Investments in very young children are vital to our economic future and must be part of any economic development plan. These are the reasons so many Alaskans from a variety of sectors have gotten excited about early learning and what Best Beginnings can do. Best Beginnings enjoys a good working relationship with both the Department of Education and Early Learning and the Department of Health and Social Services. Both commissioners serve on the Best Beginnings Early Learning Council, along with representatives from the business, nonprofit, foundation, and education communities. In FY07, Best Beginnings received funding from the Department of Health and Social Services for startup costs and the development of a plan for a quality rating and improvement system, and more about that in a moment. Funds from the Early Learning Programs component in the Department of Education and Early Learning served in FY08 as the state's contribution to the Best Beginnings Public-Private Partnership, a model showing great success in other states. And we anticipate continuing to partner with EED in FY09. Last year, the appropriation was $400,000, and Best Beginnings received $150,000 to help carry out our work. However, for FY09, the amount has been reduced to $307,000 in the House budget, and that will in turn reduce funding for the Best Beginnings initiative. A great deal has been accomplished in a short period of time, and momentum continues to grow. And to keep it growing, I ask you to see that funding is at least at last year's level. Now, some of Best Beginnings' accomplishments over the past 17 months or so are described in the handout that you have. Best Beginnings has been able to leverage the some $317,000 in funds from the state, with more than three times that amount in cash and in-kind donations from the private sector. We are not asking the state to be the sole investor in early learning. Our partners in business and philanthropy are stepping up to the plate, but they don't want to be the only investors either. I want to share a few of the things this partnership has accomplished. We worked with the governor's office to submit a proposal to the National Governors Association, and Alaska was one of only 10 states to receive a $10,000 grant for a governor's summit on early learning. In addition, a number of companies, organizations, and the state made cash and in-kind contributions. All of you were invited to the summit, and Senator Davis and other legislators were there along with 150 other Alaskans. I delivered the recommendations from that summit to the governor's office yesterday, and the topics we discussed with you today are on the list of those recommendations. Along with other partners, we're conducting a public engagement campaign, including radio and TV spots and a website. The campaign informs all Alaskans, and parents of young children in particular, about crucial brain development in the early years needed for later success, and importantly, what quick, easy, inexpensive things adults can do with young children to foster this development. A quality rating and improvement system, or QRIS, is an organized method to assess the quality of a child care, preschool, or Head Start program, to communicate with parents how good the program is through a 5-star rating, and to improve the program. We want every child who spends time in away-from-home settings to have excellent learning opportunities there to develop their brains, their social skills, and so on. Development of a QRIS is included in the state's Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Plan, which is this booklet that is part of your packet. And it's also included in the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force report that you have a copy of as well. So this is an idea with support from several places. Best Beginnings developed this plan through a contract from the Department of Health and Social Services and with a committee of Alaskans and three nationally recognized consultants. And as we came up with the plan, as we completed the plan, we came up with these diagrams, which are also in your packet. And they look like this. And as we look at this particular diagram, across the top it talks about Alaska's early learning system. And then underneath that is in-home kinds of learning opportunities, and the blue circle is out-of-home programs. The other diagram that you have in your packet really is a diagram of the quality rating and improvement system. And I just want to point out that it has that all the pieces that are here about quality standards for programs and for teachers and others, the assessment, monitoring, and rating the programs, financial support to ensure that there's access, incentive payments and technical assistance that also will improve program quality, professional development support, and providing the rating results and education to parents and other consumers. We feel like this QRIS really provides the framework for all of the early learning programs that are provided in away from home settings. So that would include this focus on a standards-based early care and education system incorporates child care, preschools, Head Start, and family child care homes. And this framework really can provide for accountability for funds and consistency of standards across all these programs, and provides parents with the information that they need to ensure that their children all have really top-notch opportunities for learning. And all the topics that you'll hear about today are incorporated into this framework or this quality rating system. And now I'd like to introduce Melinda Myers to you. Melinda is the senior manager for Best Beginnings, and she'll give you more details about the quality rating and improvement system.
Just a minute, please. Senator Elton?
Is it appropriate to ask a question now while we are switching a little bit?
Senator Davis?
It would be fine with me if you want to do it that way.
And if it's going to be addressed in the future, just, you know, say hold on to your hat. But, I mean, as we talk about this, as we talk about delivery of services to kids that are yet to get to the K-12 system, I mean, who's the service provider? I mean, is it an ad hoc group of providers and others? Is it something that should be under the umbrella of the Department of Education? Who does the monitoring for consistency and quality control? Or, I mean, have you gotten to that point?
I think that Melinda may talk about that in her remarks, and we can come back to that question as there's more information.
That's great.
About that.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for having us today. As Abby said, my name is Melinda Myers, and I'm the senior manager with Best Beginnings. So I'm here to talk to you about a standards-based early care and education system, which is also known as the Quality Rating and Improvement System. The Department of Health and Social Services contracted with Best Beginnings to develop a plan for a QRIS through state funding through fiscal year 07. The plan has been provided to the Department of Health and Social Services, and they are currently reviewing it. A QRIS is an organized method to assess, improve, and communicate the level of quality in early care and education settings outside of the home. A QRIS empowers parents to become informed consumers and choose high-quality programs for their children, enables policy members to implement policies proven to improve quality, promotes accountability to donors, legislators, and taxpayers so they feel confident investing in improvements for quality, gives providers a roadmap to quality improvement, and improves the health and development of children in all early care and education programs. The system incorporates the items that Abby just reviewed in this one diagram, so I won't go over those again, but that's a very important piece. And then programs are also rated on a 5-star scale, which includes the following: staff qualifications and professional development, environment, curriculum and learning, leadership and management, and family engagement. Why is this so important for Alaska to have this quality rating and improvement system? It's important because currently there is no system in Alaska that ensures the many facets of our early care and education system are coordinated, and which provides support to all types of programs that Abby mentioned, such as Head Start, certified preschools, licensed or military child care centers or homes, and school district preschools. A QRIS does this. It is also a critical piece to have in place when introducing other early learning initiatives such as pre-K, and will help to ensure Alaska's long-term economic success. So who's going to be responsible for this quality rating and improvement system? The state will need to provide oversight and have ultimate responsibility for the system to ensure its success, but pieces of the system could be contracted out, or there's ways for other funding to come in and for other players to be a part of. Nationally, there are 14 states that have a quality rating and improvement system, and over 30 states are planning or implementing one right now. 3 states have shown overall quality improvement and better child outcomes: North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania. and three states have shown their QRISs accurately measure quality with meaningful distinctions between the levels of their STAR program. Additionally, Pennsylvania reversed the trend of declining quality with their QRIS in only 3 years, which is very impressive. As Abby said, to keep the momentum going after the development of this plan, a field test of the quality rating and improvement system should occur. In your packet, you will find information about the field test that is proposed. The two-year field test will cost approximately $1.1 million and will include 18 center-based programs and 23 home child care programs. That will impact approximately 800 children in our state. I hope you will support a field test of the quality rating improvement system, and I appreciate your time allowing me to speak about it today.
Okay, then we can go back. Is that complete? Okay. We'll go back to the question that has been asked by Senator Elton. If you want to answer that now.
The question really had to do with who is responsible.
Yeah, I guess, and just to add another wrinkle, I mean, it's easy for policymakers and funders, you know, to look and say, okay, Department of Education, you're responsible for K through 12, and University of Alaska, you're responsible for post-secondary. I mean, but what kind of a structure is needed for preschool kinds of things? And then I guess the additional question would be, I mean, a significant difference also is that in elementary and secondary, if a child is of a certain age, there's compulsory attendance. And I would suspect that one of the things that happens is parents, responsible parents and good families may participate more fully in preschool than families that maybe don't have the structure, and those are the ones that may be the most problematic. And so I'm making what should have been a simple question perhaps more complicated, but
yes. I wonder if you would have time for us to have a lengthier conversation.
Sure,
about
absolutely.
That, because you've brought up a variety of issues that were not specifically part of the presentation, but certainly ones that we'd love to be able to
okay.
chat
yeah,
with you
about.
Yeah,
that would be fine.
I think that just noting that Best Beginnings is really working to ensure that all children, wherever they are, have good quality learning environments. So whether they're at home, or whether they're in programs that their parents select for them away from home, that the bottom line really is that families have the choices, have good choices to make about what happens with their young children, and then how they move into elementary school. But I'd love to have a longer conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Is there someone else? Oh, I'm sorry, okay. Senator Thomas.
Yes, thank you. Just a quick question. Anticipating you're successful, what is the state's contribution going, or responsibility going forward from after for fiscal year 10? What do you anticipate in your discussions with the two departments, I guess, education and social services, as far as what kind of personnel and resources they need?
There will indeed need to be more resources allocated in order for to ramp up implementation of the quality rating system. We have some information about sort of the take-up rate and how long states are taking for programs to become part of this voluntary system. Melinda, do you have some of that?
Yes, data? A couple of the states have shown that it really is dependent on each state, but
sure.
Some are showing up to 75%, 100% participation. Pennsylvania has approximately 100% participation in their program. There are other states that have about 53%. Usually what they find is that by year three, that's when programs are really coming on board, because parents understand the importance of quality and are demanding quality in their program. So it's kind of encouraging programs to start participating and get the funding and get rated, because parents are becoming aware that, you know, why doesn't my program have a STAR rating and this one over here does, and I really want to know. So I hope that answered your question.
And just to follow up, and with that thought in mind, do you have, at least from maybe the other states or whoever have done it, some anticipated cost to the state as far as what type of personnel I needed to have involved in maintaining the program, so to speak, once it's up and running?
Well, we've done some preliminary things. Most states do have involvement at the state level. They are either contributing significantly, or it is kind of a public-private partnership where dollars are coming in from multiple funds, but the states really do have the ultimate responsibility. And usually that does entail, it just depends on the department and where it goes. And if there's staff already kind of dedicated where they can take on that responsibility, then it doesn't really take on more staff. But if you don't have the staff that can absorb that, then you might have to hire more.
Can I help?
Sure, sure.
In the, Madam Chair,
yes.
In the estimates that the consultants and our committee came up with, that at full implementation, which would incorporate some 352 programs and family child care programs in addition, that the cost for full implementation, if every program participated, is estimated to be $16 million.
Okay.
$16 million?
$16 million.
And when you said 350-some programs, mm-hmm. are you including the school district in that number with the various schools that they have and the daycare centers that you have?
It would be all the variety of programs that are anticipated to participate in this. So that would include child care programs, school district preschools, certified preschools, Head Start programs. Am I missing military-based child care, the whole variety of programs that might be participating in the program, in the quality rating system.
Did that complete the answer that you wanted, or do you want to go further?
Yes, it does, and I just had one other minor question that arises regarding the concept that it's a voluntary program, therefore there may be folks that do not participate in it and put signs up that appear that they are not only taking care of your children, but they are also educating them. This would not be any type of action that goes around looking for those and bringing them up. You would expect to do it the other way, by educating people as to which ones are rated and having lists available and information, that type of thing, not a police activity, more of an education activity, so that. Okay, all right, thank you.
Okay, let's go back to the money for this year. You said there was $307,000 in the present budget, this NDED?
Yes.
And what is in health and social services?
There is no funding in health and social services that would go toward Best Beginnings or the quality rating system in this year's budget.
And the money that you're asking for this year, what is going to be done? You completed the rating system, right?
Yes.
So what are you going to be working on? What's the next step?
The next step for the field test, the $425,000 that we've been talking about, an amendment to include in the budget. Would pay for the first year of a two-year field test. The $307,000 that's in the department budget currently, as I said, was $400,000 last year, and Best Beginnings received $150,000 this year. With the cut, we would anticipate receiving the same proportional amount, so that it would be reduced from $150,000. And what we have done with that money, what we plan to do with that money into the future, is to continue to support some of the infrastructure of Best Beginnings and to contribute toward the public engagement campaign that we have been working on.
You want to field test it, but where would it be done? Would it be so many in the public school system, or would it be so many within the Head Start program? And I understand the breakdown mm-hmm. on there, but where are you going to get this? I mean, do you say 450 kids for your test?
800.
800.
Approximately 800.
And where would they come from? Would there be a program at the school district? Would there be ongoing centers that meet your qualification?
The field test would indeed take, would recruit programs that are from the various types of programs that are on the sheet that you have. So, for example, it says 8 licensed centers. So from around the state, they would recruit 8 licensed child care centers to be part of the field test.
Mm-hmm.
They'd recruit 3 school-based preschools. They would recruit one
child care center. When you say school-based programs, are you referring to the public school system at that point?
Yes, I'm.
3 programs?
Yes.
Okay, 3 sites.
3 sites, 3 preschool sites.
Okay. I understand.
Thank you. I would like to ask Sue Hull to come and speak next. And Sue is the chair of the Fairbanks Early Childhood Development Commission. She's on the Fairbanks School Board, and she also serves as a member of the Best Beginnings Early Learning Council.
Good afternoon,
Senator. Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for giving us a chance to come and give testimony. I'm going to talk for just a minute about child care assistance, as Abby said, and I'll do just a little overview. I know that you know about the program, but just as a reminder, child care assistance is designed to help low-income families to be able to afford care for their children so that they can be in the workforce instead of on public assistance. And it's handled with a sliding scale, so the more you earn, the less assistance you receive. But even at the top end of the assistance, if you receive the maximum assistance available, there's a required copay. So even families who are receiving the top level of assistance are required to pay a certain amount. Then on top of that, if there is a gap between what the market charges for care, then the family finds it necessary to pay that additional amount. So in Fairbanks, sometimes it's as much as $200 or $300 in addition to what they might receive for those at the very top of what they can receive for child care assistance. And that's because child care assistance rates have not been adjusted in a number of years. But good news is that this year in the budget there is an increase planned because there's been a rate adjustment across the board within health and social services, as you're aware of. So the rates will now be raised to the 50th percentile. And we're grateful for that. We're pleased that it's in the budget proposal. But we'd like to point out that the national recommendation, the national standard, is to be at least the 75th percentile. So there's still additional work to be done after this year. This is a first step, and then I'm hopeful that we'll consider in future years moving beyond that level of increase. Because the bottom line is that, you know, we can debate about whether or not what the state's role might be in assisting with child care expenses for middle class families, but there isn't really much debate about whether or not we should be involved with making sure that for low income families that they can afford care. And presently, even for those receiving the highest level of assistance, there's still a gap and they're having to pay out of their pockets. So that's kind of the family side of how child care assistance works. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the dilemma that low child care assistance rates poses for providers. So one side is, you know, that when the rates aren't adequate, that it's a strain on families. But it also presents a dilemma for providers. Recently in Fairbanks, I'll start with an example. Over the last year in Fairbanks, we've lost over 350 child care spaces, closing down large facilities as well as, well, those of you in the room are probably familiar with Play and Learn. Play and Learn is synonymous with child care in Fairbanks, and yet they really are no longer in the child care business. Having closed both of their centers, they now have Play and Learn Head Start program and a resource center for providers, but they've gone out of the business. And they closed their Play and Learn West just about 3 weeks ago, and so it's been quite a hot topic of conversation in Fairbanks as to why that is. And a part of the picture is what's happening with child care assistance rates, because providers have been in Fairbanks, for example. You might charge $700 for a particular age child, but they estimate that the actual cost of care to provide that care for a provider is $1,200 or $1,300. So to subsidize by that, you know, magnitude because of rising fuel costs as well as other things, it just put the child care centers in a very difficult position, and they, in essence, said we've done this for long enough, and so they've closed. And as someone said earlier in when we were talking with someone else here in the building, they were saying, you know, it's important to look at that, because if the state isn't interested in taking over the child care industry, then maybe there should be some attention paid as to how we keep the industry viable. Because if folks close down the private providers that are willing to give that care, then someone will likely need to step in. So I guess the bottom line, again, is that if child care rates are inadequate and don't cover the actual cost of care, it's a problem for families and for providers. And so we applaud your efforts to raise rates. We hope there will be continued effort to look at that in future years so that we can get the child care assistance rates to be up to the actual cost of care. It's a little bit, in my mind, like inadequate Medicare rates undermining a viable health system. Inadequate child care assistance rates are, you know, undermine the ability for us to have a quality system of care for young children. As we've had this crisis, child care crisis in Fairbanks, and people have been concerned, you know, I've been interviewed by news reporters and the radio and the television, and what they say is, so what do we do? You know, what's the answer to this problem? And everybody'd like a quick fix, and there really isn't one. But certainly a piece of the answer is adequate child care assistance rate. If the public, if the state and the public sector isn't willing to pay for those that we all agree we should be helping to be in the workforce instead of to be on public assistance, if the state isn't willing to pay what it costs for care, then, you know, how can we really expect others to step up and pay the actual cost of what it takes to provide quality education for young children? I just want to make one final point. On Tuesday, we're having the Early Childhood Development Commission is sponsoring with the Chamber a Child Care Summit at the Chamber meeting on Tuesday. And we have some folks coming in to talk about how employers can step up and assist with making child care providers, making this a viable industry and helping employees to get the care that they need. But one of the interesting things is that I was at an earlier meeting last week with Jim Dodson, that you may know, who heads the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. And this topic came up, and Jim gave quite an eloquent little speech about how, you know, it's a matter of basic economic development for promoting having an adequate workforce and folks being able to participate in the workforce, but that also it relates to the standard of living that people have, and where folks are struggling to make ends meet, that child care is one of the things that, you know, they are willing to compromise on. And when we're talking about having young children in good situations where their brains can develop adequately and they can make the progress they need, we really need to pay attention to putting the resources into those early years. And as families are struggling economically, then for them to have to not be able to afford to provide quality and not be able to access adequate public assistance to be able to do that just undermines both the economics of the state as well as, you know, the families that are and the care of young children. So again, I guess my point is that the child care assistance rates in the budget are an improvement from previous years, but we would hope that there would be consideration for improving that further in future. That's all I have.
Does that complete your Is there anyone else?
Mark Lackey, who is the executive director of CCS Early Learning, will share some information about Head Start.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Lackey. I am the executive director for CCS Early Learning. We are a Head Start provider and also, in a very small way, a child care provider in the Mat-Su Valley and also in Chugiak and Eagle River. We provide Head Start services for 240 children. And our fee-for-service or child care aspect right now is 40 children. And maybe just to tag on to what Sue was saying, I just want to tell you briefly, that our own agency has experienced what Play and Learn has experienced, is experiencing right now. Probably over the past 5 years, we've gone from 160, 180 child care spots that people were paying for, and we are down to 40, and that's been for the same reasons. The child care rates have not gone up, and that we found that we were not breaking even. We could no longer support that program. So we've slowly phased out the amount of child care that we do for the same reasons that Sue was mentioning. So just that, from the horse's mouth. Again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you today. This really is an exciting time in our state. There really is an emphasis right now on early childhood. The research is out there in our community right now. It's in our state, largely in part to the efforts of Best Beginnings and the other service providers in our state. There's a lot of collaborative partnerships that are growing. People are working together, and I think a lot of people are seeing and realizing the value of this window of opportunity that we have with young children and with their parents and the families. There's comprehensive plans that are really starting to take root, and I really see this as a unique time in our state where we have the chance to build strong foundations and to improve upon the services that we're offering this critical population. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Alaska Head Start Association. We have 17 grantees throughout the state that provide Head Start services. And so we're one of the service providers that Abby is talking about, but we are very supportive of our partners in providing these services, whether it's talking about child care assistance rates, which you've heard me tell our own agency story, and the need for those to rise. QRIS, that is, you know, defines quality and lets the public know what a quality program is. All of those efforts contribute to all children having quality place to spend their days and their hours when their parents need to be at work. So we are very supportive. Anything that helps Alaskan children, I think, is important for all of us. Another aspect that I think is very important is our partnership and our collaboration in the area of professional development. And you'll hear a little bit more on that. But everybody wins when we create a workforce in childcare that's more qualified. And that's true for us as well. I want to just talk to you briefly about my specific area and the area that we work in, that is Head Start. Head Start has a 40-year history. Our own agency is celebrating our 37th year anniversary of providing Head Start services in the state of Alaska. Head Start is, as you well know, is primarily a federally funded program. It's very heavily regulated. There's been a lot of discussion about Head Start this year in Juneau. There's some additional funding in the budget this year, and I'll talk about that a little bit. A comment I've heard a couple times is that there's not a lot of state oversight of Head Start. And I just want to address that in the fact that it is true it's not a state-funded program. It's a federally funded program. But there is a lot of federal oversight of this program. And so anytime I hear that comment, I just want to let people know I'd be more than happy to answer any questions about the level of oversight in our program or any other program that's providing Head Start services. Head Start has a strong commitment to quality. There are degree mandates for our staff. We provide mental health services for children and families, dental screenings, health screenings are required. It's a comprehensive program that is very much committed to quality. It's an individualized program, so whatever challenges those particular children are experiencing or their families, we try to remove those obstacles so that as they hit their school years, they can be ready to be successful in their school years. In your packet, there is I think it's on the right side at the very bottom, there are several pieces of paper that talk about Head Start, and there's several facts in there. Those sheets of paper will demonstrate to you the numbers of children that we serve, the communities that we're in. They'll also show you the difference that we make. We track outcomes. We know how many children know their letters when they come in and how many children know their letters when they leave. We know how many children have a basic knowledge of numbers when they come in, and how many children have a basic knowledge of numbers when they leave. Those are all outcomes that we're required to track and report to the federal government as part of Head Start. There's also some numbers in there that point out the very unique challenges of providing Head Start in our state. Alaska, as you well know, is much different than any other state. We are very rural, we are very remote, and many times it's much harder to provide the same level of services that you maybe could in another state. Professional development is always a challenge, and one we've taken on with gusto the past couple of years to really improve the level of our teaching staff's knowledge and expertise. Operating programs where there's no road system, you know, the price of fuel and heating oil, all those things are unique challenges for the state of Alaska, and those are addressed in that fact sheet. One last thing that I want to make sure that you understand is that in HB 310, there is an increase of $600,000 for Head Start. And this was put in by the governor. The House has left it in there. And we are very grateful that they understand and recognize the importance of Head Start in our state. The association certainly has concerns about some language that's with that money. There are several strings attached. The most ominous one is that it requires matching funds, dollar for dollar, if we're to use that $600,000. That's a concern. I haven't talked to a director yet of a Head Start program that thinks that they'll be able to do that. There might be some out there, but I have not spoken to them. Currently, we're required to provide 20% match for the federal funds that we get. And so programs use a variety of sources to do that, state funds, local funds, in-kind, just to meet the 20% match for the federal funds that we receive. So having an additional match requirement from state funds becomes quite problematic. So I would encourage you to think about that, examine that as that comes before you. Anytime that you have questions about Head Start or anything in the early childhood field, I would more than welcome your questions, your discussion. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. You stated that there was $600,000 in the budget?
Yes, ma'am, in HB 310. There it is.
So you were saying it was put back in on the Senate side because it was taken out in the House?
No, it was put in the House side. It was originally came out in the House, and now it is back in there. But there is the intent language in that HB 310. I believe it's on page 11 of HB 310 that states that the money will be used for serving additional children, and it will also, the intent is that it will be matched dollar for dollar.
Maybe I'm confused on that, and we could talk about it later. We won't discuss it now, but I don't think that's the way it is. Is there any other money in the budget for, you said you have some money on the DED side. How much is that?
$307,000.
And out of that $307,000, you will get how much?
Probably about $125,000. Last year when it was $400,000, then Best Beginnings received $150,000. So if it stays at $307,000, there would be a decrease in that, a proportionate decrease in
funding. Of course. But you also are asking for the money to start the pilot program, and where is that money?
That money, we're asking that money be inserted into the budget so that the field test could be begun with FY09 money.
Okay. Simply Elton?
Kind of as a follow-up to the chair's question, I mean, that's this sheet. Could you just, and I apologize, I had to step out of the room for a moment, so maybe you've discussed it, but one of the largest components of the two-year request is financial incentives. I mean, what is that?
Financial incentives are designed to provide additional incentives for programs to improve quality, so that it might be for one program what they needed was more children's books in their program because they had inadequate resources to provide that those kinds of things, or for another place that it may be that they needed to have more resources to help with this kind of the subsidization that we talk about, so that people could that they could actually afford to pay teachers better, to have higher quality within the program.
Okay, and if I could follow up again, and the field test is limited in nature. I mean, am I interpreting this correctly, that there'd be 18 center-based programs and 23 home-based programs, but I'm assuming that's a slice of the programs that are out there. So those financial incentives, those would only be available to those who are in the field test. And how do you determine who's in the field test that would be eligible for the $400,000?
That is yet to be determined. Okay. As part of there are recommendations with this plan, but the specifics of the design will need to be worked out.
Okay.
With the hiring of contracting with a director to administrator to actually do the work.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions at this time?
I just have a couple.
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you. You know, we talk a lot, and we'd even talked earlier about, you know, trying to make sure that we assess things earlier on in life, particularly children. It saves money. You mentioned that in some of your paperwork, and we seem to be more reactive here than proactive in my short experience. So I think that emphasizing that as you find information and it's available, I think that's money well spent on putting it within the program to make sure people understand how that has worked in other places where they have implemented these types of programs. Is obvious by some of the reactions of people and how you struggle to get money for Head Start and retain money and the number of programs that have been dropped and the lack of, for a better term, lack of understanding that people might have of where this all goes. So this is not so much a question as a comment that I encourage you to make sure that people do include that kind of information. And, you know, this puts the focus, the benefit is, you know, early diagnosis, as well as the kids get an earlier start, and so their ability to get ahead in life, learn earlier, and move forward is good. It's also a focus on the family. We have kids raising kids these days, it seems, and it also this will help some of them just understand a little bit more about a family and how that goes together, because there are so many more dysfunctional families these days, and a lot of that leads to situations that perpetuate themselves. So anyhow, just comments, I guess, not questions, but you can certainly respond to them if you have any kind of response. But I would encourage you as you travel around to try and emphasize that aspect of it with people as well, and this is a small amount of money that in the long run would be far more beneficial than the way we spend some of our other money.
Thank you. Madam Chair, is there time for one more person to share information?
We'd like to hear from
Carol Prentice is the project manager for the System for Early Education Development, or SEED, at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Thank you, Abby. Thank you for allowing us to probably go a little bit over our time, and I'll try to be concise. But I have a bit of a success story, so it's a good note to end on. We are, when you look at this chart, professional development is one of those spokes. And in 1998, Head Start reauthorization mandated that Head Starts bring their staff up to a certain level. So nationally, the mandate was for 50% of the classroom staff, that they're commonly referred to as teachers, even though they're not necessarily credentialed as teachers, but classroom staff who work directly with kids, to have at least an AA degree, that 50% in the country, nationwide, would have an AA degree. And that was the mandate. So SEED was instigated through the University of Alaska Southeast, and we did receive federal earmark dollars with the primary goal. We had others, but the primary drive and focus was to help Alaska come up to those national standards. And so we started that effort in about 2003. And what I would like to do is, I think this is in your packet, this is a summary of our work, because the federal funding ended and the project was ended January 31st of 2008. So we put together this little summary document. And what I would like to bring to your attention is that on the just the opening page under what was accomplished, that in 2002-2003 academic year in Head Start, this is in Alaska, there were 15.4% of the what we refer to as Head Start teachers had an AA degree or better, or a higher degree. And by 2006-2007, that number had raised to 42.6%. And so this is to say that with a targeted effort, with resources, with you know, the will and the cooperation of a lot of different groups working together, Head Start, University of Alaska, Resource and Referral Networks, Best Beginnings, you know, a lot of groups working cooperatively, collaboratively, we really can see a difference, and we can chart that, we can document that difference. So I wanted to be sure and point that out to you as a number. And now, with the new authorization with Head Start, they have new mandates, and those are that by 2011, 50%, 2011, 100% of all Head Start teachers would have their AA degree, and by 2013, 50% nationwide would have their BA degree. So, you know, they don't just make these up. These are based on national studies that show that there is a definite link between quality care and the level of educational attainment in particular areas, early childhood for teachers. So there is a direct link between those things. And Head Start, you know, is definitely a leader in that effort. So I wanted to highlight that. And the one other thing I would like to say is that for this year, the spring of 2008, through the Department of Education, they had their Head Start collaborative money. They had a little pool of money, $30,000, that they were able to set aside to help students in Head Start, or students, the way they are students, but they're also teachers and usually parents as well. But they had $30,000 to set aside for these little sort of tuition stipends. So we put out the call and said, please submit an application. But just, you know, within about a week's time, we had 60 people in the state apply, working full time, demographically women in their 30s and 40s with a family of their own, making somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 a year. We had 60 people apply to take 6 credits in this spring semester while working full time. We could only fund 15 of them, and we only give them each $2,000 to pay for tuition. But just as an indication of how ready and hungry people are for that level of education, that we had to turn away, you know, 3 times as many as we were able to fund with that little pot of money. So the interest is definitely out there, and importantly, the infrastructure is out there too to deliver. I will stop.
Simpson Elton,
Carol. It is good news.
Yeah.
And I'm, maybe this is, says more about me than it should. But I mean, as you get a better educated workforce, I mean, I'm assuming that there is also then more competition for those better educated educators, and that creates a problem for the Head Start program because they have options that may be more lucrative that open up for them.
You're right, and actually the hierarchy in that sense is that people start out in the lowest paid, which is either family child care or center-based child care, not Head Start, but in just in other sectors of that. And when they attain their degrees, AA degree, BA degree, the next level up would be to Head Start, which pays higher and has higher requirements, higher thresholds. And then from there, the transition would be usually into the public school system where the pay is higher. So definitely there is, and Mark is very familiar with this pattern as a Head Start director, but there definitely is, of course, you know, people, when they have more qualifications, they can have, you know, benefits and a higher salary. So what we would like to do is be able to compensate people commensurate with their educational and experience level so we could retain people in those all aspects of early care and learning. And I can't resist saying briefly that another really high indicator of quality is retention, because young children, of course, they want to see that consistency in their care provider. But the turnover rate is so high because the wages are so low.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, you're welcome. Any questions, Senator Thomas?
I'm always asking a question, so thank you, Madam Chairman. I would say is all educational processes, educating us as well as the parents and everything kind of rises up is what it amounts to, and we just don't seem to be able to grasp the principles sometimes, you know, but I appreciate your view of it anyhow and see it that way myself, you know. It just keeps raising the tide, so to speak, and all the boats rise from there. So thank you for your comments.
Was that the last speaker?
And
you want to wrap up or yes. Have any closing statements?
Yes, thank you. And thank you again to all of you for the opportunity to share information with you about these critical issues and for your very thoughtful questions and comments. It's always good for us who are sort of in the work to have this kind of conversation with policymakers who demonstrate a real interest and commitment to making sure that our very youngest get what they need for the future as well. And we appreciate the support that you've provided for young children and their families in the past, and encourage you to support this year funding that includes funding for Best Beginnings work, for Head Start, for child care assistance, for parents, and you've heard how that affects both parents and providers, and to support a field test for the quality rating and improvement system, which we think will set the framework for continued improvement in the infrastructure of the whole early care and education system. So thank you again very much.
And thank you very much. I'm pleased that you were able to come before us. I'm sure there are other questions to be asked, but we will take that time after we close out. We have 10 minutes before 3. Are you going to be around for a while?
Yes.
Okay, and I appreciate you taking the time to come down, all of you. And we're pleased that you're moving forward, but I have some grave concerns because I don't see that money in place that you're talking about, but we'll discuss that a little further. And thank you very much, and we'll just adjourn at this time.